You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 7th to the 13th of November 2013. My name is Chris Parr. I'm joined today by writers David Matthews and Matthew Rice and books editor Karen Shook. We will be discussing academic bitchiness and asking, does rudeness serve any useful scholarly purpose? That's one to wait on a little bit later. We will have a lowdown of what you'll find in this week's THE book section. But first, our lead news story this week looks at the tough decisions the UK higher education sector will face after the next election, given the current trajectory of government austerity. David, you had this story.
Yes, so this is based on a new report by Institute for Fiscal Studies, which has looked at what's going to happen mainly after the next election in 2015 to funding for the Department for Business, Innovation and Skills, which funds higher education. Now, obviously we've had big cuts in teaching grant offset by tuition fees up to now, but the kind of government austerity programme is, at the moment, set to continue until 2017 to 18, depending on a change of government in 2015, of course. What hasn't been decided is how those cuts are going to be allocated between departments. So the IFS makes a hash of trying to see how it could be distributed and how higher education would suffer. And it maps out a variety of scenarios. So, for example, all departments could be cut equally. That's one possibility. And that would leave BIS relatively, well, not too badly off. So almost an 8% cut between 15-16 and 17-18.
That's a good scenario, isn't it?
Well, yeah, exactly. This is what we've come to, I suppose. But however, currently the overseas aid budget is protected, as is the spending on the NHS and schools. And if this continues, depending on how the government models what people have, how people have already been cut, BIS could be cut by 11% up to almost a quarter. And basically, to cut a long story short, the IFS says no matter what cuts happen, there's going to be some serious pain for HE coming down the road, because the only alternative, the only way to shield HE is by cutting further education to such an extent it wouldn't really resemble further education anymore. So it's essentially spelling out some pretty nasty options for how the sector could save money in that two-year period after the election. So cutting students, cutting the remaining teaching grant, which still is around for high-cost subjects, and cutting maintenance grants for students, all of which aren't particularly nice. And perception is this is a sort of early piece of lobbying, because the piece was, the IFS report was actually commissioned by Universities UK, basically saying, please don't ring fence the NHS and schools, because otherwise this will mean serious pain for universities.
Yeah, we had a similar discussion, didn't we, sort of not so long ago with the spending review. And it seemed on that occasion that Willetts and Vince Cable actually had the ear of Cameron and Osborne to a certain extent, and the cuts that when they came through weren't as big as they were at first feared, though still obviously significant.
Well, one of the suggestions in the IFS report is saying, well, actually, things would be much better if the government managed to find £11 billion and put that into departmental spending. Of course, what it says is, you know, you have to find this from extra taxes or more borrowing, which is obviously a much bigger political debate entirely. Mm-hmm. But it is kind of saying to ministers and trying to sort of probably galvanise the sector, look what's going to happen after the next election. We've got to be thinking about this now. We've got to be prepared for this. Of course, it is lobbying, and you can argue, you know, that money would be better spent elsewhere in government. But obviously,
well, freezing
the UK putting out their stall.
Freezing the NHS budget, for example, or ring fencing it. Removing that ring fence is not going to be a politically smart move, is it? Not one that you can envisage any political party. Sort of
probably not. I mean, I spoke to David Palfreyman, who's director of the Oxford Centre of Higher Education Policy Studies, and his point was, higher education really is never going to be that big an issue, that big an electoral issue. I mean, obviously we had massive fees protests, but unless you raise fees again, I mean, how do you get, you know, kind of levels of teaching grants. I mean, is that really going to be featuring very highly in the sort of leaders' debates coming up to the 2015 election? Not really. I mean, you know, A&E departments and schools and, you know, bills and gas bills and that kind of thing are going to feature much more highly.
Yeah, so they're not doorstep issues, are they, for your voters? No. Interesting stuff. Definitely worth a read this week. Matthew, your feature this week starts with a quote from Clive Bloom, who's Emeritus Professor of English and American Studies at Middlesex University. He says, "It seems to me that academics are the rudest people on earth." Is that what your feature sets out to, I don't know, to prove, to discuss?
Well, I don't think it sets out to prove that, but it certainly comes up with some pretty remarkable and both amusing and horrifying examples of academic rudeness, both in reviews and face-to-face. And by reviews, I don't only mean anonymous reviews, but signed reviews. Mm-hmm. And it goes on to look at whether there's anything to be said for this. I mean, it can be quite entertaining, obviously, but it equally obviously upsets people unnecessarily. So the question is there anything to be said for academic rudeness? That's one of the questions. And some people take the view that, you know, the pursuit of truth has to be pursued fairly rigorously, and a lot of pussyfooting about or pretending that you really admire somebody and then, you know, and then say a few nasty things afterwards is a bit dishonest, and it's better to be direct and upfront where you disagree, and that actually the progress of knowledge will progress faster and more effectively that way.
No, that's an interesting point. I mean, what about people's reputations as well? I mean, is there something to be gained in terms of your future career if you're seen to be an uncompromising character?
Well, I think I talk a bit about the different disciplines, and in philosophy, it's kind of sort of bare knuckle fighting is often the way that the subject is discussed, and people present a paper, particularly if they're famous. Everybody sort of charges in and tries to make them look like an idiot. And some people think this is fun and stimulating, and other people think that it's childish, and that there's also the issue about whether it ends up excluding people. And obviously rudeness has a role in excluding people. You know, academics might put down administrators or technicians, people between post-92 and pre-1992 universities. There's often very condescending, rude attitudes, and it's a way of excluding people. And there's also the issue about whether this very macho, combative style of debate sometimes is something that women don't particularly like. But I also quoted a woman who said that she absolutely loves it, and that she has to be polite and demure and nice in the rest of her life. And it's great to go to a philosophy conference where you can really, really put the boot in and fight your corner. So there are always two views on these issues, as there are with all academic issues.
My favourite anecdote from the feature was Deborah Cameron, who's a professor of language and communication at Oxford, and went to a conference in Germany and thought, great, lots of really senior academics have turned up to my lecture. But as soon as she started lecturing, they all ostentatiously opened their newspapers and read throughout the entire lecture, just to show their disapproval of her or what she was saying or whatever.
But the additional point there is that they were all men.
Yes, it was interesting.
Yes, I think they were kind of old style traditionalist men who didn't approve of feminist academics. But I think the point she makes is actually this was probably a rather ineffective form of protest. I mean, she was ended up, people must have thought she was much more important than they would have otherwise if it had just been, you know, 12 people in a room listening politely. Mm. And then after that, everyone must have thought she was a real danger and she had to be excluded.
Mm. I just wonder, Matthew, if you would, during writing, whether you have any thoughts on whether people in academia are more rude than in other professions or areas of life. Is that, I don't know, is it possible to judge?
I think it's hard to judge. I think there are particular styles of academic rudeness, really, the kind of review where someone is sort of roasted alive with every, you know, every footnote questioned, and queer into something that's rather hard to do. It obviously does demand a very deep knowledge of the subject and then being applied in a very vicious way to someone else.
Interesting stuff. And we have, as journalists on the Times Higher, of course, have been subjected to our fair share of academic rudeness in our time as well, although names will remain out of this podcast. But yes, comments under some of our stories, certainly phone calls from academics. Karen, you interact with many academics on a weekly basis. Have you encountered any?
Well, I don't know how I should feel here. Obviously, reviews are one field in which academics who have a thirst for blood exercise it on others. Our review section is not particularly ill-tempered. I would say that in a collegiate environment, there is also a price to be paid for being openly nasty. Yeah. And I find a lot of reviewers blunt their lances. And I think it's not necessarily a question of how senior they are. Obviously, if you're a junior academic, a postdoc, you are unlikely to write a nasty review of someone who might be in a position to take it amiss. I think it comes down to the individual personality. I feel that more often than not, scholars, out of kindness actually and collegiality in a sense of there but for the grace of God, which, or Mrs. Do As You Would Be Done By, as you mentioned, do blunt their lances. And in fact, there's fun to be had in reading the arcane language of a book review, which is actually a massive diss, but to a non-academic would appear to be quite a mild, thoughtful comment. It would have been interesting if the author had considered additional areas, which actually translated means, what a moron, didn't mention that one.
So
I'm learning this. I'm just not sure that it's going to stand me in good stead if I'm trying to insult someone in a pub. So this week's book review section, I'm afraid, doesn't contain a remarkable number of examples of rudeness. However, we do have some fantastic books. Continuing on with the rising tide of First World War books, this week we have a review of David Reynolds' The Long Shadow, The Great War in the 20th Century. For anyone whose life was changed by Paul Fussell's The Great War in Modern Memory, they may be interested to read this book and discover that that book has never been translated until recently and published in France. And the poetry of Wilfred Owen and Siegfried Sassoon was not translated into French until the very end of the 20th century. And Reynolds makes the point that the Anglo-Saxon, British and Commonwealth view of the importance of the First World War and how it looms in our memory may have a lot to do with the literary tradition we associate with it. And in other places, it takes a different shape entirely, maybe because they neither had a Rupert Brooke nor a Siegfried Sassoon. That's reviewed by Alex Danchev. I'm also delighted to say that I've got Philip Hoare reviewing for us this week. He's senior lecturer in creative writing at the University of Southampton, and his book, The Sea Inside, was a book of the week for us earlier this year. He's an absolutely beautiful writer, and this week he reviews Carol Maver's book, Blue Mythologies, Reflections on a Colour. And if you think it's odd that you could write a whole book about the colour blue, or indeed a whole book review, this proves that you can. Madawi Al-Rashid reviews a book by Leila Abu Lugard called Do Muslim Women Need Saving? Madawi Al-Rashid, I think, is very well positioned to consider this issue. She's author of A Most Masculine State, Gender, Politics and Religion in Saudi Arabia, a book that we're reviewing as well. And also, speaking of eminent female academics this week, Geraldine Van Buren, QC at Queen Mary, reviews the latest book from Martha Nussbaum, who considers the place of political emotions. This is very much an analysis of the more humane parts of scholarship and politics. She looks at people like Lincoln, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Martin Luther King, Gandhi, and Nelson Mandela, who she is in fact writing a book on at the moment. And the closest we've got to rudeness this week actually is in the author profile from Martha Nussbaum, who says that she never liked the East Coast. She thought it was far too snobby, and she's quite glad to be in Chicago where people are friendlier.
Very good. Well, last week, Karen, also, you recorded a books podcast with Angus Deaton. Also, anything but rude.
Eminent economist and an absolutely lovely man who abandoned Scotland for America and still retains a bit of a Scottish accent, I think, and all of his charm.
Yeah.
If you haven't heard it, please do give it a listen. He's a wonderful man.
Yeah, along with the previous seven books podcast as well, which are all still available on the podcast section. There's another one this week as well. I met Ben Nelson, who is the CEO of the Minerva Project, a rather interesting new university that's launching. Do check that out as well. But that's the end of this week's THE Issue Review podcast. You'll find us, as I always say, on Twitter, on Facebook, on LinkedIn, on Google+. Do get in touch if you want to comment on anything that you have read.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.